Tēnā koutou katoa and hello everybody. Welcome to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. My name is Ben Adelberg and I'm coming to you from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. Tēnei ka mihi ke te mana whenua o Aotearoa. And we acknowledge the local tribal authorities of New Zealand.
And g'day, I'm Emma Strutt and I'm currently coming to you from Darumbal country in Queensland. Before we dive into our conversation today, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. Finally, if you enjoy this poddy, please subscribe, like, share or comment on our social media and consider buying us a coffee if you'd like to help support our work. Now on with the show.
We've had two conversations this season on creating better urban living environments. In episode 7, Dr. Emily Fly spoke about the importance of a biodiverse urban environments for human health. And in episode 11, the benefits of urban greening and nature corridors was discussed with Professor Sarah Bekeshi. This episode, we'll be exploring the topic of degrowth, another popular topic this season, within the ideal urban settings.
That's right. So today we're chatting with Perry Zay, an urban planner and sustainable transport professional who serves as head of mobility at Pollock Consulting. Perry is also a committee member for Degrowth Aotearoa New Zealand. Perry's vision is to create more inclusive, connected communities who are supported to live good lives while staying within planetary boundaries. Perry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Perry, all of our episodes, we start off with a little bit of a backstory, just getting a bit of a sort of an understanding of where our guest comes from and just puts things into perspective. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. So I grew up in suburban Upper Hutt, which is where I am now. So that's, for people who don't know, it's about 45 minutes train ride from Wellington City, Ponaki. And it's a small city, but one that's really beautiful with lots of gorgeous bushwalks. And that was my upbringing, was very, very much steeped in having a beautiful background to explore in. We had quite a simple upbringing. We weren't very well off, but we had what we needed, and my grandparents lived over the hill in the Wairarapa, and we spent a lot of time with them. And they had quite a big influence on my life. So my opa was a lifelong member of Forest and Bird and Greenpeace. And so he was an environmental activist and in his own way. And so I've always had kind of environmental roots through the way that I grew up. When I went to, after high school, I started university, and I actually got a leadership scholarship to study business, which at the time wasn't my first pick to study. But when I was a student, $5,000 seemed like a hell of a lot of money. So I went with 2 feet into business school at Massey University, which was quite interesting because one of the first courses I did was Economics 101, and that both enthralled and frustrated me to no end in terms of you know, how important it was, but also how backwards we had it. And I guess I couldn't really put that into words then in my first year of university why I felt that way. I later went on to study overseas, which was a really big a big experience for me. I studied in Amsterdam in the Vrije Universiteit, and I'm Dutch, so that was awesome to be there, but also to see a different way of living was really transformational for me. And I studied politics, and I studied development studies, and so I sort of went more into the areas where I was much more interested in. But at that university, I had a really one lecture which I'll never ever forget, and that was about degrowth. And at the time, I didn't know enough about it to kind of take that with me into what I was doing. But it was a really transformational time, I think, in my life, where they set up the first time that I heard about, well, you know, we have two options. We have this kind of techno-optimism path, or we have, you know, another way to go. So, yeah, that's where I originally started off thinking about degrowth. But then I went into urban planning, because I was really interested in cities from my experience being overseas. So there's a kind of a story there from how I got into back around from planning into now what I do. But yeah, that was kind of my upbringing and university.
So you've mentioned the word degrowth. It's something that we've been mentioning a lot this season, and we've had a number of amazing guests to talk about it. But let's start off with the concept of planetary boundaries. Something we've spoken quite a few times on the show, but haven't actually been mentioning a lot more recently. It has been updated 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I think, confirming that 6 of the 9 are well exceeded. Tell us a little bit about, help us define for our listeners what planetary boundaries are, why it's so important.
Yeah, so I guess a really simple way is to think about is the sort of safe zone, and the safe zone for humanity in terms of where in those different things that we can measure is a place that we can still thrive, and the we being not just us as humans. and I think that's really important when we have these conversations. It's to also center, you know, all living beings in that royal we, rather than just thinking about us. You know, I'm not a scientist, so I don't know a hell of a lot in terms of the individual measurement of those planetary boundaries, but certainly the planetary boundaries are a really useful tool for us to start saying, actually, at all these different scales. So say, for example, at a city scale, I mean, I know that Dunedin just looked at using the donut, so the donut economic model, to say, actually, at a city scale, what are the things that we care about that we can ensure that we are within these planetary boundaries when we make those decisions, and that we're protecting, you know, the safeguarding the well-being of people. So the usefulness of that tool is that it can be scaled up and down to different decisions, and helps us think about, you know, the breadth of things that we need to ensure that we can sort of move forward and thrive.
And you're a committee member for Degrowth Aotearoa. We've been very, very fortunate to have a number of members on in the past. So hopefully the long-term listeners will be familiar with the concept of degrowth already and how it can work. But for anyone that is newer around here, maybe just briefly, perhaps let's talk shop on degrowth, or, you know, donut economics and the overlap there. What's it all about? How it kind of is important for staying within those planetary boundaries? Why we need to go that direction, basically?
Yeah, I like the Jason Hickel's definition of degrowth, which is a planned reduction in energy and resource use to bring the economy back into balance with the living world in a way that reduces inequality and improves human well-being. And I guess, for me, when I think about this, and for me, it's mostly centered around the way that I think about my children and, you know, the next generation in terms of how, in terms of, I guess, the decisions that they will be able to make and what choices they will have. And I think about, you know, that it really struck me when I started to understand the, you know, the exponential growth, the doubling of the economy. If we have a 3% growth rate, we double it 24 years, and the link between energy and economic growth. And at what point do we say, actually, it's just not possible to keep doing that? And we have known that, obviously, since for a long time, and, you know, since very much since the 1970s limits to growth work came out, that, you know, that made that very clear in a global sense. But I think about it, and I think, you know, my children are 4 and 6, and if we are doubling our economy in 23 years, and then, you know, and then that exponentially keeps growing, what choices will they have when we've used all those resources to, you know, to build the energy systems out that we need, you know, to satisfy the size of the economy now? And actually, what's the point? I mean, a lot of our economy is not useful for to make us happy, and actually it's making us unhappy. So I know you've had really amazing podcast guests, including Simon Show and Mike Joy and et cetera, about the detail of that. But for me, it just you know, as soon as you start engaging with that concept of, you know, it is impossible to have infinite economic growth on a finite planet. It just almost seems bizarre that we have to justify that to, you know, to change the system when, you know, really the existing current system, you know, there's no empirical evidence that we're going to make the changes that people assert we're going to be able to make in terms of reducing our, you know, decoupling GDP from, you know, impact, environmental impact. So, yeah, I think to me it's the only, degrowth is the only thing now that I feel hopeful about in terms of where we're at, our predicament. And I feel, you know, as a mother, it's a real challenge to hold on to all of that knowledge about where we're at. But degrowth does give me hope because it's a way out, but a way out that we can look after each other. Yeah. And so nothing that I've kind of come across before that gives me enough hope that we're going to be able to, make it together.
So the concept of degrowth is giving you grounded hope, but let's just take a step back and talk a little bit about, I guess, that self-realization that, okay, I need to change my habits. I need to potentially, maybe I won't use the word consume just yet, but I need to waste less, because I think that's what a lot of people think is less waste, right? Less plastic. I think you mentioned in one of your writings, a keep cup, you know, it's better than going through a disposable cup every day if you go and buy coffee. That realization that that is not actually what it means. It's actually a bigger shift in mindset, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, as I said, I grew up around kind of environmental thinkings. And I always thought that this kind of like, yeah, it was always focused around that kind of reducing your waste. And I always thought that that was kind of enough, or, you know, and you get fed that line about it's kind of more evergreener, consume evergreener things and you'll be fine. And for me, it was quite a shocking realization when I realized that that we're not going to get to where we to a good place if we just assume that, you know, wealthy people can put solar panels in their roof and drive EVs and we'll be fine. I actually remember.
So green growth is not actually a thing. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, I mean, it's not, there's no empirical evidence to show that we can decouple at the pace that we need now, environmental impacts from GDP. But, I just to be clear though, and I think this gets misconstrued a lot, technology is actually important, you know, for where we get to. We're not, people in the degrowth movement are not saying, you know, let's just forgo all technology or all progress that we've come to. And that's certainly not the way forward. It's just that, you know, acknowledging actually, yeah, we need to change our energy system, but we also need to use far, far, far less energy. And actually we can still have good lives while doing that. So it's about, and transport obviously is an area that I'm most familiar with. So it's an area, it's about not saying, okay, well, you know, no one can drive EVs. It's just saying that we're not going to replace every single car we have in New Zealand with EVs, and that will solve the problem. So, yeah, it's a different starting point for the conversation, but it completely changes how we come up with solutions.
I'm a fan of degrowth principles. I think it's the necessary way forward, but I also need to play a bit of devil's advocate here, I suppose, because okay. This argument gets thrown around a lot. I come across this a lot online. But how do we transition to a degrowth approach without exacerbating the stresses and the pains that are already felt by poorer income families and individuals? Because, you know, when there's jolts to the system, it's always the most vulnerable, the most at risk that seem to shoulder the greatest burden. And this change, it's not just a jolt, it's a complete overhaul. So how do we go about doing that equitably?
That's the amazing thing about the whole degrowth movement, is that it's all steeped in moving towards more equality. So it's you know, redistribution is at the core of the degrowth movement. And you know, the system as it is now is not working in terms of inequality. It's getting worse all the time, and those numbers are like, I can't even fathom the enormous amounts of wealth that go to the very, very, very few people, and then, you know, that the bottom half of the population have, you know, a couple of percent of wealth, and it's, and so I think it's really interesting that that challenge gets raised in degrowth, because yes, it's a massive transition, but the whole basis of the transition in terms of degrowth is that we do it so that we can have a more equitable society, and that social, that marrying of the kind of social and ecological principles is fundamental. And I think, you know, just giving the example of transport, you know, the sort of green growth narrative of, oh, we'll all have EVs and then they'll filter down to the secondhand market. You know, it's not, that's not a realistic proposition in the short term. You know, there's a lot of fossil fuel vehicles in New Zealand now, and those are going to cost more and more and more and more and more to run. You know, I read a quote the other day that said that it was about vehicle costs in the US. So it was it's the equivalent of 30 years of an annual transport pass in the city of Vienna. So you know when you start to think about actually, you know, for in the example of transport, degrowth says, well, actually, we all deserve to have good access to everything that we need, and we deserve to have that provided for us as a public good. And so that's really, really good public transport. Yes, some people will need to have individual electric vehicles for one reason or another, but it's actually saying, let's put our collective, you know, productive capacity and also, you know, our funds, our finances towards doing things that we can share and making sure that everyone has those opportunities, you know, to access healthcare and et cetera. And we know in New Zealand, you know, there's studies that show, you know, people don't have access to even get to hospital appointments because they can't afford to drive, and driving's the only way that they can get there. And so, yeah, when you talk about equity, I think, you know, when you distill it down to these examples, you can see that in degrowth, there's a far, far better chance, I guess, that we're going to be able to get equitable outcomes for the things that we need.
So let's talk more about transport. I'm going to be a little bit biased. I'm going to talk about Auckland, but I think it's New Zealand in general. Australia's a little bit better, but globally, or compared to global developed cities, why is New Zealand so far behind in a decent public transport setup? Now, Wellington is not too bad, but Auckland is shocking. And when you talk about equitable, you know, anyone having access, well, because it's so bad and it's so limited, where there is good, say, rail, which we don't have a lot of, it's more expensive to live there. So you're pushing out those in the lower socioeconomic communities even further away from the little that we have. But we talk about, we'll talk about what the ideal should look like, but our starting point is so bad. Why have we got to that point? And another little insert I'll throw in is, we used to have trams, we used to have more rail, not just Auckland, nationally. You could get between cities, Tauranga, Hamilton, there used to be good rail networks. We took them away, and now our starting point is so bad that, you know, we'll get to this conversation later on, can we ever even catch up? But why are we so bad to start with in New Zealand?
Yeah, I mean, successive decisions that, you know, like you say, about removing trams and about not funding the public transport that we need, it's sort of those decisions the perpetuate, don't they? Because then once you've made those decisions to not provide people with public transport access or remove that access, then more people use cars, and then the more people that use cars, the more sort of social license there is for that type of development. And so those things perpetuate. And as you say, it does differ city by city, or, you know, region by region. And in the Wellington region, for example, we have a really excellent you know, train network that's really, really well used to get people from, say, where I am in Upper Hutt to Wellington. And, you know, there's other parts of the public transport system that, need to be, you know, fixed. But it is a matter of poor decision making and poor long-term thinking. And, you know, it's really hard to reverse some of those decisions because you know the built environment is once you embed those decisions into the built environment, it's so difficult because there's so many kind of legal and social political things to unravel when you get to make those decisions. But as you picked up on, there's a huge amount of inequity in how, you know, in where public transport is accessible from. I mean, there was an example the other day when we talked, when I went to a conference, a rail conference, but we were talking about bus access. You know, in Eastbourne, which is a more well-off community, there's a bus from Eastbourne to Wellington City, and then Wanamata, a community nearby, you know, there's not, and that's a far larger community. But it, in the same where I live in Upper Hutt, you know, the half of Upper Hutt has train stations, the other half has a train line and no stations. And so, you know, in the of course, it's the poorest half that doesn't have train station access. And so, you know, when I, there's people that I see all the time that are walking into town with their shopping because they can't afford they can't afford to drive, and that, you know, the bus doesn't get them where they need to go. And so, you know, it is really, you know, there is a huge amount of inequity in that. So I guess, and then in terms of New Zealand, you know, we have low population density with perpetuated urban sprawl. So it is really difficult then to reverse that and say, actually, you know, we don't have the base numbers, you know, in population density to sort of go the other way. So in some ways it does need to be built back up, you know, and I think in New Zealand we far too often focus on the one big project. You know, it's like okay, we're going to do this one massive thing, and we can announce it, and everyone will get be like, you know, yay, like a, you know, the tunneling under the Waitemata. But actually, you know, like giving that example, I worked it out the other day, back of an envelope calculation. You know, the tunnel. Just the car tunnel under the Waitemata, the figure for that, if you had taken that and distributed it instead for active transport, for example, or even public transport for the tier one cities, so the regions that are the you know, expected to be the fastest growing, you know, Wellington, Auckland, Hamilton, Tauranga, Christchurch, then, you know, you could give each city, I think it was $3 billion, you know, and then each region $3 billion, and then they could, you know, I worked out how many, it was like thousands of kilometers of cycleway, you know, like it's just, you just, you know, we're just putting our money towards the wrong things. You know, the same with up here, we have Transmission Gully, which was an enormous, enormous, enormous project, which has only saved, you know, a couple of minutes of time for people who are in their cars. And so, yeah, the reason we have poor public transport is because we focus on the wrong things, and yeah, those decisions are really hard to reverse. And we focus on the big things instead of, you know, diffusing that funding across lots of little things that we need to get right. You know, like the buses are not usually thought of as, you know, they're not politically sexy, so, you know, they get forgotten, but actually, you know, they're so critical, and we've seen, you know, really successful projects transform, you know, how people get around in bus priority, for example. So, yeah, we need to do a lot more of those simple projects.
Do you think there's like a secret sauce to help bring about these shifts in mentality where people are more receptive to, you know, rather than adding an extra lane to the highway, putting in more bike paths, or, you know, more train stations? Or is there an easy way to help shift people's mindsets here, or are we up against it?
There's some really amazing narrative work that's been done by an organisation in Wellington called The Workshop, and they talk about how we talk about transport, really does matter for how people perceive, you know, those issues. And they've got tested narratives in terms of, you know, talking about what we value. And you know, I think, you know, from my involvement on projects, it really does matter. That it sounds, you know, that comms is matters so much about how you tell the story about what the why you need to do that, and about you know, because as soon as we start getting into like an us versus them narrative about, you know, they're a motorist and, you know, and I'm a cyclist, it's not helpful, and it puts people's puts people into categories. And I think there is a way, and there's work being done more on this all the time, but and also I've seen that, you know, our comms and in these projects is getting far better because the people working on it are joining together, and they're all kind of developing this way of communicating. But it is I think the secret is actually it's about how it's communicated, it's about how you work with communities. So you know, there's local government in the past has you know, has often done things in a way that make community not trust them, and so you're starting off on the wrong foot. But you know, a really good process where you're really transparent about how things are being done can actually really help build trust and mean that future projects are more successful. So there's, you know, there is some really amazing work being done, and you know, it's not without its battles, but especially where cities can tell a overarching a story of kind of the network effect. So you know, we know from research that if you put in a bike network, for example, instead of just a lane, it has a far bigger impact in terms of the amount of people who mode shift to biking. So there's a when we start to tell that story and also start to involve, you know, the particular people that we're trying to help. So children getting to school, for example, was a really big one. You know, whenever we were in engagements about a bike lane, sometimes as soon as you start talking about a child and their, you know, right to get to school safely, it does really change people's way of talking about these issues. So yeah, it's I think, you know, there's a couple of things that really matter, sometimes we get them wrong, but I feel like more so as an industry, the transport industry is really stepping up and getting that right more, which is really cool to see.
Now, communication is only a part of it. I've mentioned on the show a number of times that I made the difficult and painful decision to not own a car. And that started by living in Brisbane, and Brisbane has a fantastic network. Train, bus, bike lanes, ferries, so well connected, fantastic. Came back to New Zealand and I thought, okay, I'm going to give this a go. So I try my best to take trains, buses and so on to get around the city for my own job even. People want to use the public transport. The problem here is it's one thing when the city offers half-price transport to entice people to get onto those buses and trains, yet half the buses are cancelled, trains are late, ferries don't show up. So the reliability is not matching the communication. So good work might be done to show the health benefits, all these other good things. But do you feel that a big challenge is having enough resources, drivers, you know, to drive buses and trains and so on, enough resources and financial backing to build more bike lanes or bike networks and so on, because projects do take years to build something that literally creates a couple of kilometers.
It's a super interesting question. I'm glad that you asked that, because coming back to degrowth, we're using our productive capacity on things that don't matter, on, you know, on bullshit jobs and on, you know, on things that production of things that actually are not useful. And things like this do matter. You know, people, as you say, getting to where they need to go, to work, to whatever, matters. And so, you know, if we don't have enough bus drivers, that's something that you know, we can say actually That's something in society that we need, you know, transport is a fundamental, you know, basic human need. So we should be orienting our economy to make sure that that provision of, you know, of services there, you know, whether that means paying just bus drivers more or whatever. And also you mentioned about the expense and particularly talk about bike lanes. Again, that's an interesting comment, because what we often see is that bike lanes are done in a kind of what they say like gold-plated way, because they're trying to reduce the impact on cars and on the, and trying to minimize the disruption, and also trying to minimize the trying to minimize the reduction of car parking space, for example. And so, like, for example, in down, you know, areas near where I am, they've done, you know, a very expensive cycle lane that's off road, but they had to reconstruct the whole thing rather than just reallocating some of that road space. So that's an existing asset we own, you know, and that's a public space. And at the moment it's been used for cars, you know, like two lanes each way and then car parking. And if we said actually a lot of that, you know, we need to get more people around better, faster, you know, and that means providing, reallocating some of that road space, those projects can be far cheaper. So not always, of course, sometimes you do need to, you know, construct, you know, a cycleway with proper, you know, proper construction. But there are cases like in Wellington where they're doing, you know, a whole network in, you know, in a matter of a couple of years by reallocating road space using, you know, not temporary, but kind of in between temporary and permanent measures. And in as an industry, we'll get far better at that, and it will actually get cheaper if we invest in it. So you can see the, you know, the Climate Change Commission's advice is that all tier one, so this is the cities we expect to have the most density in the coming year, so Auckland, Wellington, Christchurch, Tauranga, for them all to have complete bike networks by 2030. So we're talking not very far away, and some of those cities have no infrastructure. So for example, where I live in Upper Hutt, there's almost zero safe bike infrastructure. And as you said, you know, you had given up a car. Like we went down to one car. We live rurally, so it's quite hard, but we'd got down to one car and I bought a cargo bike. It was beautiful. It was so much fun. But every single day that I went out, I felt more and more stressed because, you know, we were riding on the road and there's no protection at all. And I had, you know, my small children with me, and I actually had to cross the motorway to get to school. So when my son started school, that was the only way to get there. And so every day I just felt more nervous about the, you know, what could happen to us if, you know, if I misjudged that or whatever. And so I ended up selling my bike, and now we have two cars, which, you know, is awful as someone who's like, so I get it, because I'm a, you know, a sustainable transport advocate, and I really, you know, I want to live that way. And you know, we've chosen to live semi-rurally, even though we're in biking distance from the city, I'll say, like, it's 10 minutes bike from the city. So if there was bike lanes, you know, we can bike, but yeah, it's there's a long way for us to go.
But I mean, Ben's already mentioned this earlier in the episode, but in New Zealand and Australia, we have very sprawling cities. So to make a city walkable or bikeable or have a really high quality public transport system, that makes it a little bit harder. Clearly, our cities can't continue just sprawling endlessly. And as more and more people kind of move to cities for work and to live, it's got huge implications for human health as well as the health of the planet. So what are some of the other kind of key principles or keys to healthy urban design that we can kind of weave into the narrative here, apart from trying to create a really good quality public transport system and, you know, the networks for walking, biking, etc.? What else can we be doing to address those problems?
So the 15-minute city movement has been quite a useful way to think about that. So I know that in Melbourne, for example, they looked at how they might provide more things that people need in walking and biking distance using that 15-minute model, and that's been used more and more in different cities. We definitely do have big sprawling cities, and I think if we can start to say, actually, there's even, if we grow more food closer to where people live, peri-urban kai growing, and that goes to small scale kind of shops where in neighborhoods where people this is a complete change of how we provide, from the supermarket duopoly to, small scale local grown, local local shopping. But there is a way we can get closer to that, and certainly, for example, again, where I live in the, it's the poorest half of town, and the only shops are a petrol station, a fish and chip shop, and a bottle store, and a dairy, and so you can't get healthy kai. You can't, from walking from your house. So, and at the other end of town, it's slightly different, which, it makes sense because, they're wealthier and they have, been provided more things for their communities. But if we took an equity approach, we might say, actually, we need to change that. And so, I think there's a lot of, beyond transport, there's a lot of kind of, planning principles that we can apply. What's interesting about it, though, is it sort of falls between a lot of different industry. There's transport and there's planning, and then there's urban design. And to me, sort of 15-minute cities sort of sits somewhere in the middle, where it's sort of spatial planning that we tend not to do very well in New Zealand.
Yeah, when I look at where I live in Auckland, it's very specific. I've chosen to live in the suburb that I live because I have everything within maybe 20 minutes. Mm. Supermarket, haircut, physio, osteo, absolutely everything. But there's not many suburbs within Auckland that offers that. So it's exactly your point, where so many of the suburbs, in fact, no, I wouldn't even guess, but a big percentage where there's no rail. There's buses, but probably takes you 2 hours to get from that point into the city to get to work. But a supermarket's probably a 20-minute drive. Everything, because it's so sprawled, you need a car. It's the only way you can get around to drop kids off at school, to go to your groceries, go get a haircut, go do this, go do that. It's to change that, I dare say it's not going to change. you're going to have to bowl down properties, single dwellings, to put up high density to then justify a business to be there and sell groceries or sell whatever it is.
But could we change the urban planning scheme and allow for, smaller grocery stores to be within a suburb? It doesn't have to be all houses. Like, we could be adding in smaller stores so they are local, like start decentralizing it.
Yeah, it's interesting. Actually, I made a submission recently on our on the plan change, because I'm a planner, so I wrote my submission about exactly this, about in the neighborhood that I live in, and I explain that what we have and that we need more zoned, suburban commercial type land, small scale retail, and pharmacies and healthcare. We need more a library, like that would be nice, something for the community, a cafe, and it got there was no mention of it in the response. I think they said it was out of scope of what they were considering. So I think this is the thing that I was saying, is that we haven't sort of matured to the stage yet where we're actually thinking about cities at the spatial level and going, what is it that we need here and here? We should be doing that, and to be fair, we are more doing that now, but we haven't got there yet. And so I think we can. And I think the other thing that's interesting about when you think about it from a degrowth lens is that we want to make the most of the things that we already have, right? So that's a kind of a we're reducing material energy throughput. But say we have existing buildings that are not being used for something that's useful. So it's an old, community building that's not being used for whatever reason. It's like, can we go, actually, that could be our new library, or, you know, or is it, you know, or could we say, actually, you know, there's other, you know, parts that we can retrofit uses into that are good for our community. So I think it's also about being clever about that, rather than these kind of, again, wholesale big, you know, flash things. It's actually, what can we do at a incremental, small scale, hundred of those kinds of decisions, rather than making this one big change.
It's interesting you make mention of libraries, and I apologize to our listeners, I keep reverting back to Auckland, but hey, this is where I live. But when one looks at every inner city suburb, every single one of them has or had a library. That building still stands. Some are still active. Some have been sold privately, or they've been converted into a community building, whatever. But there were, exactly as you say, every little suburb had its library, probably all had a fire station. Now we've got one per 10, you know, because we can't fund them. Like, they all were almost self-sufficient. And then, as I mentioned earlier, we had the trams. We had everything connecting it all. Those 15-minute cities existed. And then, of course, it changed. Let's talk about then, okay, well, if I live here and I need to get there, I need to get there. And short of getting in a car and sitting in traffic all day and polluting those that are walking and biking and so on, and like we said, we're in the midst of a climate crisis. In terms of the options that we have outside of a vehicle, we have buses, we have trains, ferries sometimes, but well, that gets a bit more complex. But walking, biking, scooters, all that kind of stuff. What's more important versus what's easier to look at implementing into an existing infrastructure, an existing urban setting?
I think it's probably the wrong question. I think we need to, you know, we need to provide people with choices, transport choices, right? And that's going to mean that, you know, on some days, you know, someone might want to take public transport, they might want to bike, they might want to walk, they might want to take a share car, or like you know, they might want to order a car for someone to pick them up, an Uber. And I think, you know, we need to make sure people have transport choice. Otherwise, because the other thing too is that people's needs change over the course of their life, and it also changes over the course of the day. As you mentioned before, you know, you go and pick up kids, that's a different type of journey than you might have, you know, to go to work. Like, for example, I have to drive because, as I said, there's no train stations, but I drive to a train station nearby and then I train to work. But I have to have that car so I can then pick up my child and then come home. But previously we would have taken a bike. And so it's all about providing choice. And as I've said before, to me, it's about providing those things, using what we already have. So it's about reallocating. And, you know, I guess an example of that, previously I worked at in a local government authority, and my role was called Healthy City Design Lead. And one day I was looking at the GIS, so the maps of the city, and I was just struck by how much of our public space we allocate to moving and storing cars. And I'd asked one of the technicians to calculate it for me, because they had these different layers and they could do it. And it was astounding, you know, when they came back to me, you could see that, you know, then it was like 70% or something of our public space was allocated to that use, you know, of our public space in the city. And that's crazy. I mean, you know, why do we do that? Those cars are sitting idle 90% of the time. So yeah, it's a really, I think when you start to pull at those, you know, assumptions of how a city should be, we start to realize actually we have assets that we could be using in a far different way, and moving far more people in less space. You know, in the example of bike lanes, you can actually move a lot more people, and, you know, the bus lane, of course, and a train, you know, in a smaller space than you can in single occupancy or even double occupancy vehicles.
This has been a really, really fascinating discussion in covering everything that needs to change. But obviously, I mean, we've already talked about it. It's going to take a fair bit of work to get there.
Yeah.
So we need a lot of voices to, you know, really make that noise loud. You took part in a panel discussion about local climate action earlier this year, and I think you spoke about some subjects that will really resonate with a lot of listeners, you know, from your initial belief that people just needed to learn the facts and then they'd change their actions to then feeling a bit of disillusionment, coming out the other side. And it seems like you've got quite a fire in your belly now for advocating for meaningful change within the community. So talk us through your journey from, you know, your initial keep cup smugness, to use your own words, coming out the other end and discovering your agency as a change maker, and how can other people have that same journey and learn how to use their voices?
That's a a good question. I keep cup smugness. It's quite funny actually. Like I feel in some ways I feel like I've like I always thought that I was doing the right thing, and I think that's quite funny to me now that I was so sure, like that, you know, that I kind of had all of my ideas I thought about what the change we needed to make, I was so sure of them. And now it's kind of amazing to me now that I've changed my thinking about what needs to happen. For me, where I left off in the beginning in terms of telling my background, I talked about, you know, becoming a planner, and I was an urban planner. And for me, I got into that because I was really intrigued by cities. But I was actually working as a consents planner, and we work on, you know, site by site developments. And actually, interestingly, I was in that system complicit in perpetuating sprawl, and keeping house prices high, and, you know, perpetuating homelessness. And it's quite shocking. And I think my planner friends will, be like surprised to hear me paint it that way, but it is true. You know, we the planners were enforcing the rules that said you can have a single house on a, you know, on a 400 square meter lot and not more, and people would come in and say, oh well, I want to live in intergenerational housing. I would be like, no way, like what are you talking about? I remember this one time someone came in and said to me, oh, you know, you're just making the housing crisis worse. And at that time, I'd never heard of the term housing crisis because it was kind of new to media to be talking about it. And I went back to my desk and we were all talking about it. And I didn't really, it didn't really sit with me until much later when, you know, I realized he was right, you know, like, and so I think that there's a moment in it for a lot of people in whatever industry they're in, you know, who will realize that actually whatever dominant paradigm we're sitting in actually isn't serving us, and so that was quite a crushing realization actually. And I had a what I now know to be like a really big burnout, and I couldn't, literally from kind of one day to the next, I couldn't do it anymore. And I had it was a consultant planner, so I had a business and I had lots of clients, and I just got to a point where I just couldn't be in that when I didn't believe in that, you know, in what I was doing. And to be fair, you know, planning has changed a lot, and now there's we are enabling, you know, density, and, you know, there's planning is moving on from that dominant paradigm. I moved away from being a planner, and I got a job Healthy City Design Lead, which completely changed the way that I thought about all of that. And I started to see that actually as planners, we had such an influence on people's health, but we didn't know it. You know, like I had no idea for all those years of working as a planner that what decisions that we make about, you know, what goes where, and the same thing we're talking about, you know, where shops go in relation to people's homes, or you know, whether, you know, all of those bits and pieces, the same with transport engineers, you know, when I was having those conversations from a healthy city design lens, people were going, oh, I didn't know that I was having that impact, or that those kinds of problems with things that I was perpetuating. So That was a really interesting, like a really big change moment for me. And then I realized, so I was working in a local government in a city nearby, and in the city that I live, I could see that this kind of thinking wasn't happening, and there was no movement, and you know, there's no bike lanes being built or anything. And I was kind of waiting around for someone else to say something or to be, you know, to make a noise about it. And no one was. So I realized that person may as well be me. And it was quite fun, actually. I started turning up to council meetings and my sister came with me. And so me and my sister do this activism together. And I mean, it's so much fun because it means that we can kind of dip in and out of it when you don't have the energy, because it does require a lot of emotional energy to be, you know, to prepare a presentation for the committee meetings and to, you know, to have those political conversations and to try, you know, to drive a cause and, you know, and take the ups and downs that come with that. So yeah, that's been really fun, and we've, you know, joined up with other people who are now making the calls as well, and that means that I can kind of dip away from that and I can get into other activism. And so it's interesting now, and I sometimes call myself an activist, and you know, it's sort of like with a bit of hesitation, but you know, I am an activist, and I think that there's this safety in numbers, right? So the more of us who are in, you know, who are doing activism and who are asking these kinds of questions about, you know, criticizing, you know, the possibility of infinite economic growth. And the more of us that are having these conversations in all those different spaces, no matter what industry that you're in, the more change that we can have individually if we all start making those connections. So, I think there's a lot more. It seems to me, even in the last 6 months to a year, that chorus is getting louder. You know, we can kind of see each other across the room, you know, like you're the disruptor, and you know, and you're a systems thinker too, you know, like it is really about the people who can see the bigger picture and who can start to see that you know, the house is on fire, and we can go, actually, together this is how we make a difference. And I think, yeah, it's what's cool about New Zealand is that because we're so small in Aotearoa, I feel like we can make that, you know, there's enough of us that are connected, we can start to really shift the conversation. And you're already seeing that, and, you know, there's been quite a lot of media about degrowth, and, you know, we're starting to get conversations in, you know, political parties, and you know, media commentators are starting to ask questions of political parties about this kind of thing. Shout out to Bernard Hickey and his The Kaka podcast, and he interviewed Dr. Catherine Knight recently. And I think, you know, when those conversations get into more places and we all start saying that same thing, yeah, that's when the power is. And so, yeah, there's a really exciting, it's an exciting time to be together and be connected.
Arguably, some, if not all, of the world's best cities in terms of experience are those that have very little, limited, or even none in terms of vehicles in the centre of the city. More connectivity, more pedestrian flow, it's more of a vibe, people are just freely moving around. There's more happening in that space, connected. A lot of people are passionate about that here, even in Australia. I mean, Australia has some snippets of it in their main cities, but Auckland, minimal, if any. And when a city does try to be bold and take away a lane, just one lane, or take one lane away of parking just to put a bike lane, there's a lot of backlash. There's a lot of pushback from businesses, from motorists. And then eventually they start to see it. There is a demand, but you have to go through that pain process to help me to get there. But I just feel we do it too slowly. I just think we should be more aggressive and just do it, get it done, and people will get it. So those that are passionate about a more connected environment that they live within, you know, they want better public transport, but they just want that ability to, that everyone's included. How can they enable that? How can they get involved or be more of a voice? Or do we have to storm the Auckland Harbour Bridge and just walk over it just to make a take stance and get on the news to talk about it? What should we be doing as a community to try and enable this to happen quicker and better?
I think there's a role for everyone, isn't there? And I think, you know, some people like me, you know, will enjoy or tolerate, maybe, I don't know which word it is, but, you know, going to council meetings and presenting, and some people, as you say, will, you know, want to do the more overt activism of, you know, of occupying a space or, you know, protesting or, you know, walking the Harbour Bridge, whatever, or both, or whatever it is. And there's also, you know, people who are already in those, who are, you know, there's people already in the sector and who, you know, who can have conversations quietly so that they're not, you know, they're not being those overt people, so that they are still able to be in the tent, you know what I mean, in terms of, you know, and so we all have a role, whether that is, you know, being an activist in any way, because you can do that in merited ways. And I think, but I think if, you know, if you're someone who is interested in this and you just want to get started, I think the best way is to connect with a group that exists, if there is one. And if there isn't, you know, it's probably you that has to start it. And I think, that's kind of that's my realization of, you know, if you look around and no one's saying this, you know, and where you live and you think it's important, then, you know, it really probably has to be you.
Well, Perry, thank you so much. It's been a really fascinating chat about something that we've never spoken about. We've never spoken about how, you know, I think a lot has been in isolation, a lot around how we can be living better. But transport is more than just transport. It's more than just getting to a job or dropping kids off at a school. It's about connecting a community. And that really touches on so many other facets that we have covered, being, you know, more self-sustaining within a smaller region. It's better for our health, better for our well-being. Transport is an enabler of that. It's excuse the pun, a connector of all those dots. So thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Thank you both for having me. Ka kite.
Thank you for listening to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. If you found this interesting, make sure you subscribe and share it with your friends.